Hubble will not be over until we have federal legislation basically saying Bristol Bay is protected forever and it's permanent.
The Army Corps of Engineers upholds its decision halting the Pebble mine, but advocates say they'll continue to fight. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 16th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Governor Dunleavy defends a correspondence school allotment program deemed unconstitutional by a recent court decision.
Public school students trying to get a public outcome, a public educational outcome, by using a whole host of different vendors, both private and religious.
Governor Mike Dunleavy is defending the state's correspondence school program. That's after a Superior Court judge declared cash payments to Alaska homeschool parents for educational expenses unconstitutional. The state's homeschool allotment program reimburses parents up to $4,500 per year for curriculum, activities, and even private school classes. The ruling found that the practice violates a section of the Alaska Constitution that prohibits the use of public money to directly benefit a religious or private school. The state plans to appeal. On Talk of Alaska today, Dunleavy focused the argument on the direct benefit portion of the constitutional language.
Our argument is that it's an indirect benefit to the institution. It's not a direct benefit to the institution. And so what we're talking about here is public school students trying to get a public outcome, a public educational outcome, by using a whole host of different vendors, both private and religious.
But lawmakers disagree, saying the allotments in their current form do violate the Constitution. Here's Anchorage Democratic Senator Bill Willikowski.
That's not how I interpret that. I think it's pretty clearly a direct benefit. There was a lot of discussion about what direct and indirect benefits were during the Constitutional Convention, and I don't think that was what their intent was.
In the House, lawmakers said they wanted to wait for the court case to proceed before considering a legislative fix. House Education Committee co-chair Representative Jamie Allard, a Republican from Eagle River, suggested amending the Constitution to allow for spending on private and religious schools.
Would I be open to saying, okay, that the dollars can follow the child and be used in a faith-based school, but maybe not pay for that Bible study class? I think that's a good compromise.
House Education Committee co-chair Representative Justin Ruffridge, a Soldotna Republican, said a constitutional amendment would be a worthwhile discussion, but said the proposal faces long odds in a closely divided House. Senate President Gary Stevens, a Kodiak Republican, said he would not support amending the Constitution. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has upheld its denial of a permit for the proposed Pebble Mine upstream from Bristol Bay. The decision issued yesterday is the latest in a long string of legal and administrative rulings against the project, but opponents of the gold mine say their fight isn't over.
Pebble will not be over until we have federal legislation basically saying Bristol Bay is protected forever and it's permanent.
That's Lindsay Bloom, a strategist with Salmon State, part of the coalition of tribes, native corporations, fishermen, and lodge owners that has fought the mine for decades. More than a year ago, the Environmental Protection Agency issued a final determination that a mine in that area of the Bristol Bay watershed would damage or destroy miles of salmon streams and more than 2,000 acres of wetlands. The decision is referred to as a veto. In its decision Monday, the Corps said as long as the veto is in place, it can't issue a permit. Pebble Vice President Mike Heatwell says the company is focused on a lawsuit seeking to overturn the veto. He points out that the Corps' decision is based on the veto and didn't address Pebble's points on appeal. The Corps said its decision is made without prejudice, suggesting that Pebble can request a reconsideration if the EPA veto disappears. A national environmental nonprofit named the Kobuk River in northwest Alaska among America's most endangered rivers today. Advocates for the Kobuk say threats posed by the proposed Ambler Road and mining projects are a big part of why it was chosen. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George has more.
Growing up, China Kantner spent half the year on the Kobuk River at her family's camp near the village of Ambler.
In the fall time, we would go upriver, wait for the caribou to go through, pick berries, maybe get a couple of pike, dry some pike while we were there.
The Kantners would spend winters in Kotzebue and come back upriver in the spring in time for geese and caribou. Kantner is a member of Protect the Kobuk, a group of 700 people, mostly residents of Northwest Alaska. They're fighting to block development of the Ambler Road, a proposed 200-mile industrial road that would cut through the Kobuk River's watershed to access copper and zinc deposits.
Growing up this way has made it really clear how important it is to protect what we have. This is totally a food security issue. We want to protect what we have and the animals and plants that we rely on.
On Tuesday, the environmental nonprofit American Rivers released its annual list of 10 endangered U.S. rivers. Rivers facing immediate threats from climate change, pollution, and development. The Kobuk is number 8 on the list. Sarah Deardall is the Northwest Region Director for American Rivers. She says no protections come with the endangered status, but it helps to bring attention to rivers that are facing an imminent threat.
Our most endangered rivers report is really highlighting a river in crisis that's at a crossroads and where there's an opportunity for action in the next year.
The Trump administration issued federal permits for the road in 2020, but President Biden suspended them 2 years later, saying the environmental analysis was not adequate. The Biden administration released a draft analysis last fall and is expected to deliver a final report very soon. The New York Times is reporting the administration will deny permits for the road. But even if that happens, activists are preparing for a long fight. Kantner sees parallels to the decades-long fight over Pebble Mine in Bristol Bay.
People in that region have been fighting Pebble Mine for a long, long time. And so I think it's clear to us that we have a lot of work to do, regardless of what the decision is.
Ambler Metals did not respond to a request for comment, but the company told the New York Times in October that it's confident it can address any environmental concerns brought up in the report. The road also has support from Alaska's congressional delegation and the state-owned development bank known as ADA. Clarence Wood Grippentraug grew up in Ambler. He's 26, Inupiaq, and commercially fishes for Chum Salmon in Kotzebue Sound. He says he's concerned about the road interrupting caribou and bird migration and pollution coming downstream from the mine threatening salmon, shefish, and other species.
Everything's connected here. Our water shed is our lifeline. If that water gets contaminated, we're all doomed.
Wood Grippentraug says he expects a prolonged fight over the Ambler Road, but he says the Kobuk River has supported his people for thousands of years. It's worth fighting for. In Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Sitka biologist spots a species of whale rarely seen so far south.
Rounding the bend and heading toward Canada into the Beaufort Sea to feed for the summer. So this young whale went the wrong way.
A formal process began this week in Anchorage to document Native boarding school abuse. The project is part of the U.S. Interior Department's Federal Boarding School Initiative. The National Native Boarding School Healing Coalition will conduct 3 days of interviews. Although the testimony will be given in private, it will become a permanent part of a national oral history collection. In many cases, children across the state were forcibly taken away from their families and sent hundreds of miles away to boarding schools where they faced physical and sexual abuse. Boarding school survivors have also said they were beaten when they spoke in their native language. The session began with opening ceremonies yesterday at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan is heading to Europe next month to try to convince trade officials there to ban Russian seafood. That was one policy goal the senator said he's pushing in the coming month during a visit to Kodiak's annual commercial fishing trade show, Comfish. KMXT's Brian Venwa reports.
Sullivan addressed the elephant in the room early at Comfish, which was concerned about the historic challenges fleets and processors are currently facing. Seafood processing companies like Trident are divesting from Alaska, citing market issues. The state's fishermen have also seen historically low prices per pound for their catch. Sullivan spent a significant amount of his time blaming Russia for the tough year.
We are at an economic war, in my view, in the fisheries industry with Russia, and to a related degree with China. Our officials in the U.S. government need to recognize this. because the Russians recognize this.
Sullivan said Russia held a market advantage after it banned U.S. seafood products a decade ago. The U.S. embargoed Russian products in return. However, Russian-caught fish was still being sold in American markets through a loophole. That loophole was closed when President Joe Biden signed an executive order late last year that takes effect next month. Sullivan claims Alaskans are also disadvantaged by unfair labor practices in other countries that undercut prices on a global scale. He says he's been trying to work with Japan, one of the world's largest buyers of seafood, to fix the problem.
So I was able to engage with a number of Japanese senior officials, our ambassador to Japan, pressing them that they should institute a Russian ban on seafood as well.
Sullivan says he's also going to Europe later this month to meet officials there about instituting a similar Russian seafood ban. He says the goal is to fill any demand in gaps with Alaskan-caught products. U.S. Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo also sent a video to supplement Sullivan's remarks. She told attendees that recent work with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is more progress for the seafood industry.
For the very first time, the U.S. National Export Strategy, released by the Commerce Department, includes a chapter on seafood that was drafted by NOAA.
Sullivan also talked about wanting more research in mariculture as well as including fisheries in the upcoming federal farm bill reauthorization. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Benoit.
In late March, a local whale biologist in Sitka spotted something out of place in Sitka Sound. She's still having a hard time believing it, but pictures suggest an incredibly rare sighting, a juvenile bowhead whale. KCAW's Catherine Rose reports.
In late March, marine biologist Ellen Chenoweth was out doing something she's done dozens of times before, looking for whales in Sitka Sound, with a videographer and a Mount Edgecombe High School student.
We kind of went out on the water hoping to find some bubble netters, and we poked around, cruised off the shoreline there, found a few whales, but you know, not really what we were hoping to see. And so we were actually turning to go home and just trying to get any IDs that we could on the way back to town.
They were in the middle of the sound, just south of Inner Point, when they saw a whale surface. But it didn't look like the humpback or gray whales that frequent the area.
I kept thinking that maybe I wasn't like seeing what I thought I was seeing in terms of like, was it a different part of the body than I was expecting? At one point I was like, is that a tail? Like, what am I looking at? But it was just the head bobbing at the surface.
Chenoweth was able to snap two pictures of the whale's head from different angles.
And then it just kind of went down and disappeared. At the time, I just thought, you know, my brain isn't processing this. I'm just like not finding the bucket that this belongs in.
The whale didn't reemerge, so they tried another tactic to ID the whale by dropping a hydrophone in the water. But no luck. Chenoweth took the photos back to her office. She is a research faculty member of marine biology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, but she's based in Sitka. And it just so happened that her longtime mentor, whale biologist Janet Nielsen, was visiting from Glacier Bay. She agreed with Chenoweth. The photos looked weird, so Nielsen sent them to her husband, who works with gray whales. His response? Not a gray whale. So the photo started making the rounds to whale researchers around the region.
So I kind of shyly sent it out to some people and was like, it's probably just a weird gray whale or an animal that just has a weird injury or something that I'm not used to seeing. But, you know, maybe. What do you think?
Eventually, the photos made it to marine biologist Kim Sheldon at the Marine Mammal Laboratory for the Alaska Fisheries Science Center in Seattle. A coworker who specializes in North Pacific right whales poked her head in Sheldon's office one day and said, hey, do you have time to come look at something fun?
And of course, I'm like, yes, let me get away from my spreadsheets. I'll come right down the hall. And she had these two photographs up on her computer. And she asked me, so what is it? Not to bias you. I said, that's a young bowhead. And she goes, that's so. It's really exciting to see that. And I was like, well, where is it? And then what she said, that she found it, went, oh, not supposed to be there.
Sheldon said while the photos didn't show a lot, bowheads are pretty easy to spot if you know what you're looking for. Unlike right whales, their heads are smooth, and they have a very distinctive high-arched lower jaw.
When their mouths are closed, I mean, the nose, I'm going to date myself a little bit here. It looks like Jimmy Durante. It's got the top of the rostrum is just really narrow, and then these big, huge lower jaws that comes up.
Sheldon says that typically this time of year, bowhead whales are beginning their northern migration from the Bering Sea. She says it's possible that this whale, which seemed to be alone and based on size young, could have gotten lost in that process.
As soon as that ice starts to recede in the spring, they're heading north. So they're going to be heading up to Utqiagvik, rounding the bend and heading toward Canada into the Beaufort Sea to feed for the summer. So this young whale went the wrong way.
Sheldon only knows of one other bowhead sighting in the North Pacific. In 2016, a young bowhead was spotted about 200 miles south of Sitka in British Columbia, feeding with humpback whales in the area. It seemed healthy, but it too was farther south than it should have been. It's hard to know much about the condition of the juvenile bowhead whale near Sitka. That's why Chenoweth is hoping Sitkans on the water will keep their eyes peeled. Any more sightings of the bowhead whale could provide helpful information for researchers.
We kind of want to know, is this whale healthy? You know, if it is confused, could it be due to toxins or something like that? I mean, I think in addition to hoping to see this whale alive, I think there's a chance that a whale this small, that if it is a calf that's separated from its mom, it could wash up. I think just trying to understand these unusual sightings, because it does give us some insight into the rest of the population and just changes in the ocean and how animals are adapting to those.
Bowhead whales are endangered and protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. If a boater sees a bowhead whale, the approach regulations are the same as other whales in the area. Maintain 100 yards of distance and do not approach the animal. If your vessel is turned off and the whale approaches you, that's okay. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
A storm that buffeted Bethel last night clocked one of the highest recorded wind gust speeds in the city in at least 45 years. KYUK's Sage Smiley reports.
At around 10 p.m. on April 15th, Bethel's airport weather station recorded a blistering peak wind speed of 68 miles per hour.
That for any time of the year is strong, much less for a non-winter month.
In fact, University of Alaska Fairbanks climatologist Rick Toman says it's the highest wind gust speed recorded in Bethel in a non-winter month since data started being recorded 45 years ago.
This is right up there with the highest wind speeds in the last 4.5 decades.
It's only 3 miles per hour below the all-time recorded wind speed record for the city. Toman says that the rest of the region had a blustery night as well, but not quite like Bethel.
While everybody was quite breezy, Bethel certainly takes the cake for the highest reported wind gust that I've been able to find so far. And nothing else is even really close. A few other peak winds were a little over 50 miles an hour, but nothing even to 60.
To some extent, of course, Toman says the high measurement at the Bethel Airport is a function of where there happens to be wind equipment. It's not possible to say it was the highest gust in the whole region on Monday evening, but it's still quite impressive.
Wind speeds above 65 miles an hour, even for gusts, I mean, that's pretty windy for low elevations in the Kuskokwim Delta, for sure.
Toman says one interesting factor is that the windstorm didn't come from one single storm center.
The storm itself was completely unremarkable as far as the intensity of the low pressure center.
Toman says it appears a storm over the Bering Sea combined with strong high pressure over the Gulf of Alaska, winds out of the south, and winds off the Kilbuck Mountains to put Bethel in the middle of a perfect storm.
So some of it is just Bethel's bad luck. It could have been winds like that upriver or downriver a little ways or on the coast. But Bethel just happened to be in the place where all of those factors came together. It just goes to show that, you know, when all the ingredients come together, you can get these kind of out of season, unexpected events. And this, of course, can happen anywhere.
The strong wind blew KYUK's Arctic entry door off its hinges, but Bethel's volunteer fire department, police department, and city government all say they hadn't received any other reports of damage from the storm as of midday Tuesday. Toman says Bethel can still expect breezy conditions in the more typical 10 to 20 mile per hour range in the coming days, but likely nothing else record-breaking. In Bethel, I'm Sage Smiley.
A Homer-based nonprofit is turning to recycled plastic lumber for a project improving trails in the Homer area. KBBI's Simon Lopez has more.
Homer Trails Alliance is a nonprofit organization that builds and maintains trails in the Homer area. One of HTA's projects involves maintaining a section of the Homestead Trail on Diamond Ridge that gets especially muddy. Alaska Plastic Recovery collects plastic materials from marine debris, residential recycling, and industrial waste. APR then uses its mobile processing facility to turn the plastic into usable construction products. One of the products APR sells is a recycled plastic lumber made from processed plastics.
We collect it, shred it, melt it into a paste, and extrude that into forms, and that becomes dimensional lumber. And we call that dimensional lumber grizzly wood.
Patrick Simpson founded Alaska Plastic Recovery and serves as the company's president. He says the recycled plastic lumber is denser than tree wood lumber, and using it doesn't require special tools.
So this is something that might use for decking, for rails, fencing, for garden boxes, picnic tables, park benches. And in this case, which is why we're talking today, using it for trail rehabilitation.
HTA board member Billy Day says there are a few places grizzly wood can be used to improve local trails, including a section of the Homestead Trail. Day says grizzly wood can be used alongside a grid product called GeoBlock, which will be topped with wood chips to create sections of the trail.
At each seam where we connect the panels, we screw into the grizzly wood, and that helps to float it a little bit, especially in real muddy areas.
Day says the group could potentially use grizzly wood for upcoming trail rehabilitation and maintenance projects beyond what is planned for the Homestead Trail. Local environmental organization Cook Inlet Keeper helped collect plastic for APR by setting up collection bins in Soldotna and Homer. In Homer, I'm Simon Lopez.
If you're bummed out about missing the total solar eclipse in the lower 48 this month, start planning now. The next total solar eclipse in North America will happen in 2033, and the path of totality will cross northwest Alaska. For communities like Nome and Utqiagvik, locals will have a once-in-a-lifetime chance to view the celestial event. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, the eclipse is already garnering interest from tourists 9 years in advance.
Travis Rector is a physics and astronomy professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Rector says the world sees about 1 to 2 solar eclipses a year, but the next one in North America will be on March 30th, 2033.
It's going to pass over the northwestern part of the state of Alaska. So the path of totality will be visible in western Alaska, so over towns like Nome and Kotzebue, and all the way up through Utqiagvik.
Rector says a path of totality is typically between 50 and 100 miles wide, and if you're outside of that zone, you'll be able to notice a change in the sky. However, he says you're going to want to go to Nome, Kotzebue, or Utqiagvik to get the full experience. And Rector says he anticipates areas near those towns will see a high amount of visitor traffic as people flock to view the eclipse.
I wouldn't be surprised if hotels in these communities are already getting phone calls for making reservations 9 years in advance.
As it happens, there's already interest in Nome. Leon Boardway works at the Nome Visitor Center and says he found out about the impending Alaska eclipse from a meteorologist friend of his.
No sooner did I talk to him, somebody called me up and said, we want to come up there in 2033 to see this eclipse.
So far, Boardway says he's received 3 calls about the eclipse, all of them from out of state. He says Nome has had a few tourism setbacks in recent years, and he's hopeful that the city will be able to accommodate an influx of eclipse visitors.
We had a couple of the hotels burned down and everything, and then we're coming out of this culvert thing, and everything is the economy, everything kind of slowed down, but I think we're in a position now to get things going again and rejuvenate all this stuff.
Another question for prospective eclipse chasers, will you actually be able to see it from Alaska, a state known for inclement weather? National Weather Service climatologist Brian Bretschneider has mapped out the projected cloud cover for the region. While that part of the state is very cloudy, he says the eclipse will come at the least cloudy time.
If you were to pick a time of the year for there to be an eclipse, anywhere in the state, really it would be the western part of the state, which is the sunniest part of the state, and in March or April, which is the sunniest time of the year. So while the map may look like it's has a high likelihood of cloudiness. It's really the best time of the year.
Brett Schneider says the eclipse will be particularly rare for the community of Utqiagvik.
They're going to have experienced totality for about 2 minutes, plus or minus. And it is their only total eclipse in a 1,000-year period. So this is the chance of a lifetime and of the lifetime of many generations of people as well up there.
If you miss the Alaska eclipse in 2033, you'll have an opportunity for an annular eclipse in 2039, viewable from Anchorage and Fairbanks. Brett Schneider says that's when the moon passes in front of the sun but doesn't cover it.
The moon will be a little farther away than typical, and so the moon will be smaller than the sun from our perspective. And so it doesn't completely black out the sun.
After 2033, Brett Schneider says the next total eclipse in Alaska will happen in 2097 and will pass over Denali. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Kavitha George, Rhonda McBride, and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Brian Venwan in Kodiak, Sage Smiley in Bethel, and Simon Lopez in Homer. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.